Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, acclaimed writers Daniel Krauss and Susan Orlean discuss the process of adapting a book into a film and vice versa, as well as their latest releases. This program was part of the 2026 American Writers Festival. Co-hosted by the American Writers Museum and the Chicago Public Library, the American Writers Festival is a free literary event featuring in-depth conversations with diverse writers from across genres and backgrounds. This conversation took place June 7th, 2026, and was recorded live at the Harold Washington Library Center. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
All right. Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Good afternoon, and welcome to our next program here at the American Writers Festival. My name is Courtney Borjas, and I am the Assistant Director of Education at the American Writers Museum. And I am so excited to introduce our writers for this next panel. Daniel Krauss is a New York Times bestselling writer of novels, TV, and film. His latest novel, Angel Down, was a New York Times top 10 book of 2025 and was just awarded the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. His novel, Whalefall, won the Alex Award, was a Los Angeles Times Book Prize finalist, and was named the best book of 2023 by NPR, The New York Times, Amazon, The Chicago Tribune, and more. With Guillermo del Toro, he co-wrote The Shape of Water, based on the same idea the two created for the Oscar-winning film. Susan Orlean is the author of 9 books, including The Bullfighter Checks Her Makeup, My Kind of Place, Saturday Night, and On Animals. In 1999, she published The Orchid Thief, a narrative about orchid poachers in Florida, which was made into the Academy Award-winning film adaptation starring Nicolas Cage and Meryl Streep. Her book, Rin Tin Tin, The Life and Legend, won the Ohio Anna Book Award and the Richard Wall Memorial Award. They're here today to talk about the process of adaptation. Please join me in welcoming them to the stage.
Hello.
Hi.
Or good morning. Is it morning? Oh, no, it's noon. Good noon.
I like good noon. All right. So to get started, I feel like this is a question that a lot of people always want to know, and especially as someone who often deals with students who come to visit us on field trips. What was your inspiration for becoming a writer?
You know, I would have to say being a reader is what inspired me to be a writer. I loved reading from the time I started reading very young, and to me, reading was a magical experience. It seemed incredible that I could travel anywhere in the world, anywhere in time, be in different people's state of mind just by looking at little marks on a page. I wanted to do that. I wanted to be able to make that magic. And so it made me, from the time I could read, I wanted to be a writer.
It's a good question. I started writing, I think maybe like in first grade. And the reason I did it was I had a friend in the neighborhood. I lived in a small town in Iowa. And I had a friend in my neighborhood who, I think he wrote some stuff. No, what it was is we were drawing monsters. So we had this folder, and I had my own folder. We would draw various monsters, we would give them names, and then eventually we wanted them to like do something, so we start writing kind of like Godzilla versus King Kong type of stories. And then we did that for many, many years, and eventually he sort of, you know, petered out, and I kept going. So it was always from the very, very beginning kind of like a playtime. Like that was what it was. And in a way, it's kind of what it remains. Certainly never thought about it as like a career. Like, not even. Even when I was in high school writing, you know, more or less old novels, I didn't know anyone who knew anyone who knew anyone who knew anyone who was a working artist. So it's like, it was off the tape. It wasn't even. People say, oh, is this your dream? Do this or that? Like, no, it wasn't even a dream. You know, it was just completely off the cable, not in the cards whatsoever. It's basically I'm still doing the same thing. I'm still writing because I really, really like to do it. But I could imagine a world in which I J.D. Salinger everything, and I just write, put it in a cabinet. Like it's like a book coming out is not especially exciting for me. It's really, it's the writing of it.
Now, I know we're here today to talk about adaptations, and you both have had a lot of works that have been adapted into various mediums. So something that I would like to know is, whenever you're writing, do you ever picture of this could be, you know, this could be adapted, or is it something that doesn't come to mind at all, and it's just like a happy discovery later?
Well, this is interesting, because I have a feeling that Daniel and I might have different experiences of this, because as a writer of nonfiction, I think it's really important for me not to think about that. The temptation when you're writing nonfiction, if you're thinking, oh, this could make a great movie, there's going to be a temptation to shape the story a certain way that makes it more cinematic or more adaptable. And that pushes you into the realm of not telling the truth and not telling the story the way the story really unfolds. So as a discipline, but also as a reality, I don't think about it. I mean, there have been certain stories of mine where I thought, huh, you know, I can picture the visual version of this, but I don't focus on it in any way, and I think it's really important for me not to. And of course, I've been shocked by the adaptations that have come about. Like, almost always I've thought, really? You're gonna adapt? You're optioning this? This seems impossible to make into a movie. So it sort of reinforces my feeling that that's not something I should be thinking about.
We're actually perfectly aligned. definitely no. Never, ever, ever do I think about anything having to do with movies or TV or anything. I think that would be a bad idea for me. Yeah, I have my weird feelings about these things where I want the book to just be the book. And there's this, I don't know, this kind of pervading sense out there that when your book gets adapted into something else, that you in some way done something notable, and that's not always really the case. People adapt things all the time that aren't good at all.
I mean, it's sort of seen as validation of the book, which I always take offense at.
Yeah, me too.
I feel like, no. And in fact, there have been great movies made from crummy books.
Of course, yeah.
And crummy movies made from good books. So it's just that in popular culture, film is so huge, television is so huge, that being anointed as a adapted property is seen as validation.
Yeah, and there's a lot of authors I know whose careers were made off the back of like movie adaptations. Like, doesn't mean they're like amazing writers, but that was what pushed their visibility up. And then that kind of jump-started their career. And that's unfortunate that the books are still kind of secondary like that, or seen by some to be secondary. For me, the books are always the main thing and anything else. You know, if I'm adapting something myself and someone says, congratulations, you know, thank you, because I've got a horse in this race, now I'm writing the screenplay, whatever. But otherwise, if someone just get options, I always feel like the congratulations are misplaced. It's like, I didn't do anything. Like someone, you know, they bought the rights, but I didn't do jack.
Well, I will say, it's not an unpleasant thing to have someone pay you money.
Yes. Yeah.
To use your work. So, I mean, for me, I'm always thrilled, but I look at it as a financial arrangement rather than, oh, I guess I wrote a good book.
Yeah, and that's why I feel weird about it, we're talking about money. And so if someone says congrats, what they're really saying is congrats on the money, and this feels big.
Right. But, you know, it's similar in a way to being, this doesn't happen with books, but with magazine articles, frequently they'll be reprinted, and someone will approach you and say, you know, we want to reprint your story after the period of time when it's not reprintable. And so you're paid a second time. And, you know, I don't feel like, wow, I guess that was a really good article. I feel like, well, lucky me, this is an income stream I hadn't anticipated. And of course, it's a certain validation. Someone, and it's usually someone intelligent, is saying, this inspired me.
Yes.
This thrilled me enough that I want to take my run at it. So it's not without value. And it can be really exciting and interesting to see what comes of another creative person taking your work and reinterpreting it.
Yeah, and sometimes, like, I always think about that with audiobooks. Like, I listen to, usually when an audiobook comes out, I'll listen to maybe 30 seconds of it, and that's it. I just want to kind of get the flavor. I can't imagine something worse than having to listen to my own audiobook. But one time I had to reread a book for a reason, and so I listened to it on audio, and it made me think about that really as an adaptation. Because there were things about that book that had always bothered me that I didn't think were good enough. And they were fixed, sort of. Like, so it was through the screen of the audiobook reader, like through his filter, it became a better book. So there's always a chance to me. There's always a chance that the adaptation might do something really wonderful.
That's interesting. Now I've read all my audiobooks, so I... You don't read your books?
I read one. I'll never do it again.
Well, I never read my books as, you know, I never, once I've written a book, I never reread the book. And I had done all of my audiobooks except for The Orchid Thief. And so I went to my publisher and I said, you know what, I'd love to record it so that now I'll have done all of my audiobooks. So I went into the studio and realized that, you know, The Orchid Thief came out 25 years ago, and I've never read it in 25 years. And I walked into the studio and thought, what if I don't like this book? Like, it's kind of late in the game to realize this, and I was really nervous reading it after 25 years of not having read it. But I did it. I did do it, and I got through it.
That is so fascinating. I love hearing all of this. Susan, I have a question for you. So the film adaptation, very famously based on The Orchid Thief, but it takes a meta view and creates like a fictional character out of yourself. How would you like compare and contrast the adaptation process of something like that to maybe something like your magazine article that was recently turned into Little Wing? Like, how similar or dissimilar are those processes?
In many ways, the film adaptation was the dream version of an adaptation, namely that it's about the book. It's a meditation on the book, and it's truly a version of another creative person responding to the book. So they didn't take, I've had very traditional adaptations. The film Blue Crush was an adaptation of a story I wrote. And essentially, in Blue Crush is a wonderful movie, and I'm very happy to have been part of it. But what they did was essentially take a milieu that I had described and overlay a plot and characters, and it's a very traditional Hollywood adaptation of a nonfiction article. They create a fictional narrative arc. The film adaptation, you know, when The Orchid Thief got optioned, I thought it was the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard. I just thought, I cannot believe this is so much not a movie. And it's a very interior book. It's very much a meditation on what it means to be passionate about something. I just thought, I just have no idea what they're going to do. And at the time, I remember saying to my husband, they're going to put in a crime. They're going to, turn it into, instead of it just being an orchid poaching, which had a very, you know, light punishment, they're going to make it a murder. They're going to, they're probably going to throw in some car accidents, you know, very typical Hollywood. And it seemed to me the only way they were going to be able to make the book into a movie. Well, little did I know that that is exactly what was happening with Charlie Kaufman, feeling like Hollywood wants me to make this a story about a high-stakes crime and a love story and drugs and sex and car crashes. But there's part of me that really doesn't want to do that and wants it to be a meditative movie about the meaning of beauty and passion. And, you know, the magic of adaptation is he did both. He was able to, in his, you know, extremely brilliant and slightly twisted way, sort of serve both masters. And it's funny because a number of people over the years have come up to me and said, how could you have let them do that to your book? And I thought, but you know what? To me, this is the perfect outcome because it's about someone grappling with the book and what the book is about versus what Hollywood wants it to be about. And the book remains very much intact. And it felt to me like he was also channeling the considerations that I had writing it, thinking, well, you know, nothing that dramatic happens. Is anyone going to really care about this? I mean, can I write a book in which the crime, the great crime at the center of the book involves a very modest suspended sentence? Can you write a book and have it work with that sort of low stakes? So I would say in terms of my personal involvement in each version of adaptations was about the same. I take no credit in any way for the films that have been made for my work because I didn't write them. I consulted with them, but it's not, you know, the real creative work came from the screenwriter, the director, and one was, you know, Little Wing also was a very traditional adaptation. I thought they did a wonderful job. But typically, a narrative was overlaid on the story that I had written, in which it was much more of a meditation on this young girl who raises homing pigeons and what that means and what, in her case, what moving from her home meant for her birds. So, which is more satisfying? I'm a happy camper. I feel very, I've had good movies made from all the work of mine that's been adapted. Adaptation is an iconic film that, you know, I am so proud to be part of and so shocked that I agreed to it.
Thank you. Daniel, if you don't mind, I wanted to know a little bit more about the adaptation process for The Shape of Water. You wrote the novel, but it's also a collaboration with Guillermo del Toro. So with all that coming out together, how was that as an experience?
That one's a very strange one. Like, it's not... It's not like any other adaptation that I've been a part of or has happened. I think it's very rare in just sort of history. It doesn't mean it's amazing, it's rare. The Shape of Water was an idea I had when I was a little kid. So like, I don't know, fifth grade, sixth grade, something like that. And so I had always, and I've written other books that were based on ideas I had as a child. So it's like, this is not unusual for me to carry ideas for decades. And so it was, you know, as I got to be a professional writer, I had these little notebooks, and then when I finish a notebook, I sort of transfer over the list of things I still want to write to the beginning of the next notebook, the list. And I was always transferring that over. But it was never like top on the list or anything like that. But eventually I was going to plan to write it as a book, and then I met Guillermo because we were doing a book called, Guillermo del Toro, who directed Shape of Water. We were doing another project called Troll Hunters, which we were writing this book together. And that was, that's probably another question coming, but that's was adapted into a Netflix show. If you don't know your kids or your grandkids. And I was telling him about this idea for The Shape of Water, and he was like, oh, I want to make that. It's like, sure, I'm sure you do. This is never going to happen. But he did option the idea, and then when it came time to writing the script, I was deep, deep into another project. So I was like, I can't write the script with you. But I, in the interim, because it took a couple, 2-3 years for him to actually get around to making the movie, which I never thought was actually going to happen, that I was still planning on writing a book. So eventually we got together and decided, okay, you make the movie, you can be the lead on that, I'll write the book and be the lead on that. And the one example that's out there that's very much like this is 2001. So when Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke sort of came up with the idea of 2001, and then the film and the book were released simultaneously. And they both had their fingers in both. But the film it really skews heavily. This is a Kubrick's version, and the book skews heavily. This is Clark's version. And so that was very much the process of Shape of Water. It has all of them share DNA, but it's kind of messy about what comes from who and where.
You were right, by the way. My next question for you was going to lead into Troll Hunter, so I gave you points for predicting the future. I specifically wanted to know, yeah, it's an animated show. Is there a different feel when, for each, and Susan, you can also answer this as well. Is there a different feel depending on the medium that it's getting adapted into? So like a movie versus an animated show versus, you know, a television show, live action.
Yeah, my guess is Susan would have more say on this because I don't really have much to say about Trollhunters. We wrote the book and I had nothing to do with the adaptation. The adaptation's quite different, actually. Like, it follows sort of the same characters and it follows the same sort of general thrust. But the book is, they scaled it, like, down for the TV show. So it's for younger kids. The book was for more or less teenagers. And it was far, far darker. Like, it was a relatively dark book. And it had trolls doing all these really disgusting things. I had these one trolls, and these are not, didn't make it into the show for obvious reasons, but they would like, they were these big kind of shaped like an ottoman sort of, and they would, to scale people's house, they would barf up all their organs. So they were like really limp, and they could move really quickly, like spiders. And then, that's when they were vulnerable though, because then you could go to their organs bags, and you could chop up. And also they wrote pen. I just remembered this. I haven't read this book since, 15 years ago. But also they drew pentagrams on houses because they wanted all the parents to think it was a satanic cult. Anyway, where am I going with all this? I don't even remember why I'm talking about this. Oh, yeah. So I don't know. I don't know. Most of my experience has been with film. This is the only TV thing I can speak of, and I wasn't part of it. It just says adapted by the book, by me and Garen, and all that, but that's the extent of it, really.
My experience is, to my great surprise, adapting a book to television feels more natural. And it's a simple matter of, instead of 2 hours, you have 20 hours or 24 hours of time to tell a story, and it allows the kind of meandering that and characters to develop that a film, just because it's a much more limited amount of time and you have to keep everything compact, and most stories need more than that 2 hours to really explore all parts of a book. So I'm adapting the library book for television. And I never, thank you. if someone said to me, we want to make a film, I feel like I already know that it would focus on the fire. It would be, it would inevitably be just a slice of what the book tries to address, as opposed to a much more sweeping kind of narrative. And television allows that, which is great. You know, we're in the era of that kind of television, which is really sort of wonderful, I think.
I was just going to say, I am just learning that you're adapting the library book into television. That makes me really excited as somebody who loved that book. So I'm walking away feeling great right now.
Oh, well, thank you.
You know, this has been kind of touched upon in your discussion earlier, but I wanted to talk a little bit more, too. Does your relationship with what you have written change at all once it's been, you know, made into a movie, a film, what have you? And what is your relationships with the adaptations themselves?
That's a good question. I would say that my relationship to the origin material doesn't change. To me, it remains very much intact. It doesn't sort of bleed into this new version of it. They feel like distinct, separate things. And I am aware that it brings them much more attention because the numbers of people who see even a modestly successful movie dwarfs the numbers of people who read the best-selling book. I mean, it's shocking. They are not in the same... It's like one is base 3 and the other is base 10. They're just not equivalent. You know, when they say, huge flop, only sold 50 million tickets this weekend. And you feel like, oh my God, the only book that's ever sold 50 million copies is the Bible. You know, it's just... So I am aware and grateful for the existence of these adaptations, knowing, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that tons of people came to The Orchid Thief after seeing adaptation. And I don't look at them and think they're less valuable to me than the readers who came to it as a book. I'm thrilled for that aftermath of the adaptation. To me, that's where I get all my sort of added value, which is it brings readers to the original material. And that is, to me, the very best outcome. So it doesn't change my perception of the original work, but I'm very aware that many people come to the work in that order, from the film to the book, as opposed to from the book to the film.
Right, so in their minds, it's sort of a de-translation.
Right.
Almost, yeah, like a second translation, because they're coming with all the baggage, positive or negative, from the movie, and then having to erase and add things to it sort of mentally on the fly to make various judgments about it. I'm not saying that in a bad way, but we assess things. I think generally I don't, you know, it certainly doesn't affect how I feel about the books. In fact, I have a hunch that if something really bad was adapted from one of my books, it would actually make me like the book even more. It would be like, oh, look what you've been through, but you know, you're still kicking. I don't think it's changed anything. It's interesting, like, most of my books at some point or another have been optioned for film or TV, and you know, virtually none of them actually happen, but it happens all the time. And so I do have like lingering, it doesn't change how I feel the book, but I do have lingering feelings about various things, like, you know, it'd be like, this person optioned that, I knew that was never going to happen, but it might make me feel weird about that person maybe or something. Also, I've had, you know, situations where more than one, where a thing was being developed and somebody gets screwed. And sometimes it's me and sometimes it's someone else and sometimes it's a writer, sometimes it's a director. And that puts a bad taste in my mouth. Not particularly for that project, but just sort of the act of adaptation in general. And I get over it. Next time someone shows up and says, here's some money,
right.
I say, fine.
you know, I think you bring up a point that's worth noting, which is, like you, I've had many things optioned, and for one reason or another, they never came to bear. And that's a whole other part of this experience of adaptation, that it's probably, the proportion is probably 1 to 100. You know, you have 100 things optioned and one gets made. It's an incredibly reductive equation. I have certain bad feelings about things that were optioned that, for Hollywood reasons, didn't get made. And, you know, it actually makes me feel sort of more protective of the work, feeling like this should have been made. And, you know, writing a book is an remarkably simple thing compared to getting a movie made. Getting a movie made requires millions and millions of dollars and many people agreeing that this should be made in this particular way. So it's more of a surprise when something actually happens than the reverse. So I think it's important just to note that lots of stuff gets optioned. I've had many, many things optioned, and many things optioned again and again. You know, it becomes a sort of an annuity. It just keeps being re-optioned, or things that, you know, right now someone's very interested in optioning my very first book, which came out 500 years ago. I mean, which is also sort of cool to realize that certain stories, you know, they're not timely in the sense that they then get stale. But the process, it's so, you're in total control when you're writing a book. I mean, with the notion, of course, that you'll get edited, your publisher will want a certain cover, but it's so much more intimately connected to you as a creator than once things enter the world of television or film development. Your ability to control it or even see that it happens is zero. I mean, it really diminishes. And so it happens a lot that things get optioned and never come to pass. And I used to get super excited when something would be optioned and think, oh, I can't wait to go to the premiere. What am I going to wear? And now I'm a lot less, you know, I don't rush to the dry cleaner with my dress the way I used to. Now I think, okay, well, I'll believe it when I see it, which is a much more realistic and sensible attitude, because the numbers are so much not in your favor.
Susan, something you said kind of leads into my next question of, once something is optioned, I feel like, you know, for the, you know, the average fan writer, average fan or reader, they might be curious to know what the writer's role is in, you know, the production process. If you all can talk a little bit about, you know, maybe what you've experienced, what you've not experienced, or are there times that you wish you were more involved, less involved? I'll leave it up to you.
It really varies from project to project. I've had, like, Blue Crush, they sent me the script, but beyond that, I had nothing to do with it. You know, I was barely in touch with the production while it was underway. I was almost caught off guard when it was done and coming out. With adaptation, I was much more involved because, first of all, they had to come to an agreement with me to allow them to have me be a character in the film, because that was not included in the original notion of them optioning my book. And originally I said no, that I wanted them to change my name in the movie, and I did not want to be a character in the movie. So that was a whole separate set of negotiations. But then also, they Spike Jones, the director, interviewed me at great length about, you know, the story, to get anecdotal material that wasn't in the book. I mean, I got very involved. They came and looked at my clothes when they were wardrobing the Susan Orlean character. And I went on set. I was an extra, although I got cut out of the movie. It's tragic. And I think now, to be honest with you, the fact that then I lived in New York. Now that I live in LA, it's almost like by default I'm more involved, because the person who's writing the script wants to have lunch with me, and I meet them in person, and I talk, you know, it really is very different being in LA, being near the people who are working on the material, and I think in general, they like having more contact with you. I mean, I'm not sure if you've had that same experience, but I think when I was more left out with Blue Crush, I was on the other side of the country. I didn't particularly inquire about it, and I think the whole thing almost caught me by surprise. So I think it really depends on the project.
Yeah, all kinds. Usually when something gets optioned, my agent will ask me, do you have any interest in being involved with this? And usually the answer is no. Usually I'm trying to protect my writing time. And so in some of those cases, it might as well not have anything to do with me. I don't hear about anything until someone wants to option the book. I'm like, is that still optioned? Is that free again? Turns out, yeah, ran out 2 years ago, whatever. Other times, heavily involved. Obviously, if you're contractually involved as like the writer or something, then you're much more heavily involved. On this movie I did of my book, Whalefall, which I co-wrote this screenplay, you know, it's about this diver gets swallowed by a whale, right? And he's got, but it's like scientifically accurate. So he's got like an hour's air and he has to get out of this whale. I was heavily involved in all stages of that, even though I was just the writer, because nobody knew about whales, and probably nobody knew about orchids, and like, so for a long time, I was there sort of advising on whale behavior, but also like, how do we begin to conceive of what a whale stomach looks like? And I'd be like, well, I have these books, I can show you. And then they'd sort of send visualizations, and I'd say, it's still too big or whatever. And I remember this one time, someday I'll be allowed to show this photo, but like they were designing the conceptions, the conceptual art was off. They were envisioning things that weren't right. And so I took a rolled up a yoga mat, so it was like a tunnel, and I took like essentially a Barbie doll. I put the Barbie doll in the tunnel, and I draped like a scarf over the end, but there was some light bleed, and I took some photos of it, and it was kind of like, okay, this is sort of what it should look like. It's like, this is about the amount of space, and the diver's crouch like this, and there's a little light because of this bioluminescence, and the whales you can actually see, but I was, you know, doing that with actual light. So there were a lot of kind of fun things like that where I was just helping them visualize, and eventually, when we get, you know, closer to production, I was really like, you gotta hire someone who knows more. Like they'd be like, what color is this nodule in the stomach? I'm out. I'm tapping out here. I don't know. So they did hire one of my whale experts to sort of advise on the guts.
Take it back to you both as writers. You both have come up with, you know, lots of varied work. How do you find inspiration to write? How do you find, you know, what subjects grasp intrigue you? What is the writing process like for you?
That's a great question. I'm a very curious person, and so much of the time being out in the world, I'm kind of scanning for things that catch my attention that I want to learn more about. And it's often serendipitous. When I look at the books I've written, or even the magazine pieces I've done, it's almost always some fluke that I stumbled upon something that another person might just tick off and think, yeah, whatever. And my response is, well, I want to learn more. Like, this is very weird. And it can be a little mention in a newspaper, which is how The Orchid Thief came about. It can be something that I stumble on in the course of working on another story, which is how Rin Tin Tin came about. The library book was, you know, I had vaguely been thinking, God, it would be really great to write a book about libraries, but I can't figure out what the story would be, because I like taking things that are on the surface very familiar and then looking at them in an unfamiliar way. And then I just accidentally was with someone who was smelling a book and said, you can smell the smoke in some of them. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, you know, from the fire. And it was the first time I had heard that there had been the largest library fire in American history in the LA library. So, but it was truly by accident. I mean, I knew that there might be a good story to write about a library, but I had no idea of what it was. But I was probably slightly more attuned to curiosity about stories related to the library because of that. But I would say, you know, my default posture is always, ooh, I should write about that. I should write about that. It's just the way I experience the world. And I think I became a writer because I experienced the world that way rather than the other way around. I just think I think of my brain as a giant lint brush, and that I'm, you know, constantly picking up these little tiny bits that I then look at and think, wow, that could be a story.
Yeah, I've had that very same thought, like not lint brush, but like a colander or something, or some sort of like grate through which the world filters through, and like things will hit it, and I'll be like, hey, save that. So where do I get my ideas and stuff? I mean, a lot of it depends on what I've just got done doing, because I want to do the opposite of that. So if you know my stuff at all, you know I hop genres constantly, and that's because of fear I'll get bored or stuck or start repeating myself. So if I've just done a horror novel, I'll do a historical fiction, I'll do a sci-fi, I'll do a nonfiction. That's my last four books. And that's a terrible way to run a career. The worst possible way to run a career. It truly is, it sounds like I'm making a joke, it's a terrible thing to do. Because I've always lost scads of readers every time I make a weird left turn. And, you know, you gain some too, but like you're not building. You know, you're kind of going, and maybe overall you're sort of building, but it's a rough path. But eventually, if you last long enough for the idea that your brand is that you have a brand, then it becomes great. Then, like, you know, but it took like my whole career to get there. What am I talking about? Ideas. Yes. Yeah, anything that's not what I did before, as I said earlier, some ideas are stay with me for decades, some just a few years. Every once in a while, like Wellfall, there was an idea that happened immediately. And I was like, I need to write this immediately. So, as always, it's a mix.
It's interesting because I really never go back to the same subject. There are certain very broad things that, like, I like writing about animals, and so I've written a lot about animals, but in part I don't want anyone to say, oh, she's that animal writer. So I'm very happy that I'm not, you know, that I never wanted a beat, I never wanted people to think, oh, that's my lane. Although I was thinking I could do, like, one book on animals, one on vegetables, and one I could do minerals. I could. But I also think that I tend to be drawn to certain emotions that find expression through a subject. And that while the subjects seem quite random to, you know, jump from writing about a dog who's in movies to a library, many of the themes are really similar, and I keep going back to the same themes in all these books. So they aren't as disconnected underneath. Superficially, they're very different subjects. But
yeah, I think that's a great, great point, because as much as I say that I change genres every time, and, that's also true. And I think about, you know, at the stage when you go through a book and you're like editing it more fine-tuned way, and you're like, oh, I use that word too much, I gotta change those words. And I was talking with Megan Abbott, a writer, some of you might know. I can't remember what word it was, but it was a very specific word that was connected to emotion. She's like, my book is full of this word, I have to always get rid of it. And for me, the word is desperate. Like, my books are filled with the word desperate. When I have that phase, I'm like, oh my God, I've used it 70 times. So I think that tells you something about, like, there is a sort of feeling that I'm coming back to.
But in fact, I find that really interesting when I look at thank God for, you know, search and replace on a computer. But I find it so interesting. I mean, in my most recent book, Joyride, which is a memoir, and I had a lot of insecurity about feeling like, does anyone want to read my memoir? Who cares? You know. And when I did a search and replace looking for repeated words, the word that I used the most was just. And I realized it was me sort of apologizing. It was coming absolutely out of insecurity. Of instead of saying I wanted X, I was saying I just wanted. And it's a sort of tick that you use when you're not feeling secure.
I also find that when I find a lot of he could see the clouds. Like, no, he saw the clouds.
Right.
It's like, why am I hedging? He had the permission to see the clouds.
Well, same with the word would. Because if you say he would look up into the sky instead of he looked into the sky. And so I found, particularly in the memoir, which I was approaching with some sense of insecurity or unentitledness, I think I just felt like, who cares about my life? I felt unentitled to write a memoir. And I had all of these sort of conditional words that I'm happy to say I went through and removed them all and felt like it had a huge impact on the book. But it also was a real revelation to me to think, wow, I really feel a lot of insecurity writing this book. Usually the theme I'm finding is a little, somewhat more intellectual than that. It's like Rin Tin Tin was a book about immortality. Can anything live forever? Can an idea live forever? So it wasn't so personal, and yet there were, it very much related to thinking about my grandfather and my father, and you know, there it was very personal, but it was also thematically, somewhat more intellectual than with the memoir and feeling like, wow, I really feel insecure about this. But whatever word you repeat, it really tells you something. It's really interesting.
I hate to cut this off because this has been a really wonderful discussion, I know, but unfortunately we are at time. So can we all just give it up for Susan and Daniel?
Thank you all so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode from the American Writers Museum Podcast Network. Be sure to subscribe so you are notified when new episodes are released. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.